It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week, the so-called Bakken Oil Pipeline, that's the one which will carry oil across the state from the Dakotas, cleared its final regulatory hurdle when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers concluded it could pass Iowa waterways without breaking any federal environmental laws. As we've discussed several times on this program, the pipeline has drawn much criticism since it was first proposed, and this week that opposition reached new heights with an apparent arson happening at three of the construction sites. Here to tell us about it, Bill Petrosky, state government reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Bill.
How's it going?
What happened? What was damaged?
Well, I'll tell you, I talked with Newton Fire Marshal Mike Nolan. What he said was that two fires were reported in Jasper County on Monday. They included a blaze spotted about 6 a.m. in a farm field about 4 miles west of Newton, and a second fire about 2 miles southeast of Reasoner. And as I understand it, when the workers showed up at 6 a.m. in this farm field west of Newton, I think the equipment was still smoking. Somebody set it fire. And in addition to that, we understand that there was a third fire that happened over the weekend. This was in Mahaska County, about 8.5 miles north of Oskaloosa. The people think it was set early Sunday morning. And in each instant, heavy equipment, including bulldozers and backhoes, appeared to have been intentionally burned.
Mm-hmm. Have they put a dollar amount on the damage yet?
Well, what they've said is that there was nearly $1 million in damage. What you're talking about, you know, is very, very high-priced equipment.
Mm-hmm. What are the authorities saying? Do they have any leads?
They told us they do not have any leads, and they are seeking they're seeking cooperation from the public, and they also want the public to start watching these sites. And this is kind of an interesting thing. You know, people have asked me, are you surprised about this? And I'm kind of surprised and not surprised. One thing is that, you know, this project really is starting to move full tilt right now, and the goal is to really get this thing done by the end of the year. So I think you're going to see a huge amount of work happening all over the state. A little bit of work has been done on this project, really, particularly in southeast Iowa, and I understand it's really picking up in northwest Iowa, and it's really starting around central Iowa in Newton right now. But the project really started to get moving. I think the idea was that it was really going to start moving this week after this final regulatory hurdle last week, and then to hear that there was a fire immediately with some of this equipment burned was kind of a shock. It's not surprising that people are upset about this, because we know that people have been protesting this all along. But for the most part, people on both sides have been pretty peaceful about it. There have been a lot of union people who have been supporting it. In support of this, there's been a lot of business people in Iowa who have been in support of this, but there's been environmentalists and there have been property rights activists, farmers who don't want this built across their property, who have been very strongly opposed to it, but they haven't. Nobody's been threatening violence over this, so to have violence happen was a surprise.
Mm-hmm. Given that it was in three separate places, this alleged apparent arson, does it seem like it, based on what we know now, that it could be one person, or do we think we're dealing with a number of people?
That we really don't know. And, you know, and one of the things here, you know, when you get into an investigation like this, you really don't know just exactly what the real reason was behind this. And I'll tell you, one of the things that's interesting about this was after we ran a story in the paper about this, several union people commented to us. They said, hey, you know what's interesting about this is that these were Komatsu tractors and bulldozers that were burned, and the company had pledged to have the contractors use American-made equipment, John Deere equipment, Caterpillar equipment, Vermeer Manufacturing Corporation equipment, so to see company from a Japanese or you know, equipment from a Japanese company burned. I personally wonder if that isn't a factor as well. Maybe it isn't, maybe it is, but we really don't know at this point.
The Houston-based company Dakota Access LLC is building this underground oil pipeline. What have they been saying about this?
Well, what they've said is they absolutely will not tolerate this situation. They called it a shameful act by a group of people trying to disrupt our country's energy security and independence, and that they are going to prosecute anybody who's been involved with this. And what we're hearing is that the company says they're going to bolster security. We've heard the sheriff's department say that they are going to, you know, try to step up patrols along the route, but they can't have somebody there all the time. But I have talked with some of the union people, and they've said that, you know, what you'll probably see is some of the people who work on the project staying there overnight watching the project, reporting anything unusual to law enforcement. But they are also asking people in the area that if they see anything unusual, to try to report it to law enforcement.
Do we know if this will set back Dakota Access in building this damage?
I doubt it's going to have any kind of significant impact. The fact of the matter is, this is the two contractors on this project in Iowa are both from Wisconsin. They're both major companies that are involved in building pipelines. They have plenty of equipment. They have plenty of capital and lines of credit. If they wanted to call up, an equipment company and have equipment delivered on a low boy this afternoon, they could do it. So I don't think there's going to be any kind of a significant setback at all.
Mm-hmm. And remind us as we close, this is a huge project employing a lot of people, right?
Absolutely. They are talking about employing up to 4,000 people in Iowa. And what I've heard is because this project has gotten started so late and because they really, really want to get this project finished this fall, is that you are just going to see an enormous workforce out there. I talked with one fellow yesterday from the heavy equipment operators. He said he had been projecting to see 900 heavy equipment operators working on this project in Iowa earlier, and he said now you're probably going to see in the neighborhood of 1,200 heavy equipment operators. That's not talking about all the other laborers, pipe fitters, all these other people. So there will be just a huge push to get this project done. It's going to be an amazing thing. You are talking about, I think there's four different what they call spreads happening across Iowa, and these folks can lay over 1 mile of pipeline a day, which is an amazing thing.
Okay, Bill Petrosky, thanks for the update on some apparent arson at three of the construction sites at the so-called Bakken oil pipeline being laid across the state, across 18 counties from the Dakotas down to the southeast corner of the state. Bill Petrosky, thank you very much.
Good talking with you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Next, new research that is especially of interest to those with allergies or even asthma. A new study showing the differences in Amish children's immunity from children who live outside Amish communities. It's research that's breaking some new ground. Peter Thorne is with us, professor and head of the Occupational and Environmental Health Department at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. He's co-author of this new study published in the August 4th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. He joins us now. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So tell us, what was the study about, and why did you want to look at this?
Sure. Well, for a long time, we've known that asthma and allergy were rare among rural populations, farming populations that farmed in the old methods of our grandparents. And so we wanted to study the Amish, who still use those sorts of practices in their farming, where they raise mostly dairy cattle, they farm with animals, they don't use modern farming techniques, and we could compare them to Hutterite farmers. And it was interesting to study the Hutterites of South Dakota because they are also a founder population that emigrated to the United States from the Alps and the Bavaria region of Germany in the 18th century. And these two groups have very similar genetics, so it allowed us to tease apart the difference between genetic determinants of asthma and environmental determinants of asthma.
Mm-hmm. Almost like you do with identical twins.
Sure.
That you have this more or less the same set of DNA, but you have different experiences when they're separated.
Exactly.
So what did you do after that? How did you study this?
So we went to the farms of these children, and we collected blood samples for immunologic as well as genetic analysis, and we collected dust samples, airborne dust from their homes. And this was a challenge because they don't use electricity. So we had to develop a really novel method for collecting dust using electrostatic dust collectors. And we took that dust and analyzed it for its microbial constituents, and we found dramatic differences. The Amish children had 7 times as much of what we call endotoxin, which is a marker of bacteria and is a very potent immunostimulant agent. And specifically, it stimulates the innate immune system rather than the adaptive immune system.
Mm-hmm.
When we collected those dust samples also from a age-matched cohort of Hutterite children. And the Hutterites don't live on small family farms, but live in large communal farms, more like dormitories with multiple families. And so the dust was fundamentally different. And the Hutterite children had 20% asthma, and the Amish children had 0% asthma.
Mm-hmm. And the Hutterite children are farming not in the old ways or more modern ways.
The Hutterite children are not farming much at all. The fathers and adult brothers are farming, but the children don't go in the barns very much. And that's a major characteristic that differentiates them from the Amish, who spend a lot of time in the barns from birth with the mothers all through their childhood.
Okay, so what does that tell you, that it's 0% for the Amish children, the Hutterite children, 20% asthma? What conclusions do you draw there?
Well, we knew that we had a cohort of children that would allow us to investigate the immune determinants and see what was going on behind this. And so we analyzed their immune systems and looked specifically at the innate immunity, and we found that certain types of cells that are associated with asthma, eosinophils in the blood, were very low in Amish children and quite high in Hutterite children. Similarly, neutrophils, which are part of our response to inhaled microorganisms and pathogens, neutrophils were high in the Amish and low in the Hutterites. So that was a very dramatic difference. And that,
Why?
Well, to understand that better, then we took the dust that we had collected from these homes, and in my lab we extracted the dust from these air samples, and we concentrated it, and we gave it to mice in a model that shows the development of asthma. And so these mice inhaled it through their nose 3 times a week for a month. And the mice that got the Amish dust did not develop these asthma-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And the animals that got the Hutterite dust did develop allergy and asthma-like symptoms.
Mm.
So that showed us that we could recapitulate or we could demonstrate the same effect we saw in the children in the mouse model that we studied. And then when we submitted this work for publication, the journals, we had 7 reviewers, very rigorous reviews, and they said, well, why don't you knock out some of these genes that you think are responsible in these mice and test it again? So what we did then was we took 2 major innate immune genes and made mutant mice that don't have those properties of their innate immune system, and the protective effect of the Amish dust disappeared completely. And that essentially proved that this is an innate immune function that protects the Amish children from asthma.
Very, very involved, very complicated study that you're, and I appreciate you describing it to us, but when you boil that all down,
yeah,
what is the takeaway? What is the surprising thing that you or I, who might be worried about cleaning up dust in our homes, might be worried about, our family members having allergies or developing asthma? What's the takeaway?
So from about 1980 to about 2000, we saw between a doubling and a tripling of asthma rates among the general population in the U.S., and that has a tremendous burden on children and the parents, plus the medical care system. And so there's been a great effort to try and understand what caused that increase and to be able to reverse that. And this study shows us that it's our modern lifestyle and keeping us preventing exposures to these early immune system triggers that is making us at greater risk of these diseases. So the public health message, I mean, one interpretation could be everybody should have a cow in their home. Not very practical, of course, but from a therapy standpoint, if we can identify what kinds of exposures are protecting these Amish children from allergy and asthma, we may be able to make the same kinds of stimuli for the immune system that they get naturally through some other means.
Isn't the most important question whether I can vacuum less?
Ben, you can vacuum less. And
I can, and it's scientifically proven. No, I'm of course kidding. But here, so, we are too clean. We vacuum too much. We keep things too clean, especially for our youngsters.
So as always, it sounds too simple, not to vacuum versus to vacuum. It's not just – so allergens are still a problem for many people. If you have cats, if you have dogs, you have cat allergy potential. And so in this case, these Amish and Hutterite people don't have pets in their homes, so they're exposed to livestock microbes. So it's the microbiome of what we say, the microbiome of livestock that seems to be the protective effect. And just not vacuuming anymore might not suffice. You might have to have some of these animal or barnyard sort of microbial signals to trigger this immune response.
Groundbreaking results like this always usher in more questions. What's at the top of the list of your questions that you want to study further, you think, based
on
this?
I want to take the Amish dust and the Hutterite dust and analyze it further to try and find out more precisely what microbial signals in that dust are exerting this effect on the innate immune system, because that really is the next horizon here.
Peter Thorne, last time we had you on the show, we talked about water quality. You're quite the water quality expert as well. I wanted to ask you about this before we let you escape from the studio.
Okay.
Since this news came out that officials in the Des Moines Water Works say they've detected a water contaminant produced by blue-green algae. It says a microcystin level there in the drinking water, but it's considered at a level safe by federal regulators. What do you have to say about that? How alarmed should we be in Iowa, especially the people served by the Des Moines Water Works?
Well, from what I know of this, they're just doing the due diligence to monitor for microcystins in the water. And having detected it, normally what they would do is then continue to be monitoring it to make sure it doesn't go higher. And under the Safe Drinking Water Act, they're obligated to notify their consumers that this is present and has been found. They've taken the action to change the water supply from the Raccoon River, where this was detected, to the Des Moines River in an effort to have no more detectable microcystin. And if that solves the problem, then that's great for everyone and they've done the right thing. Worst case is they get a cyanobacterial bloom. Microcystins are high in say, Raccoon and Des Moines River. Then
they have a Toledo, Ohio type experience, right?
They have the potential to lose the water supply for a city of 500,000 people, and that would be a major catastrophe. So let's hope that's averted.
Okay. Peter Thorne, a professor and head of the Occupational and Environmental Health Department at the College of Public Health at the University of Iowa. The earlier study we were talking about, if you want to check that out, the August 4th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. Peter Thorne, always great to have you in the studio.
I love your show, Ben. Take care.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With less than 100 days until the election, politics are everywhere. I don't need to tell you that. Well, even though at a parade celebrating the 100th anniversary of a volunteer fire department in the small west central Iowa town of Arcadia last Saturday, had you been on that parade route, you would have seen, as one of the floats, a man in an orange jumpsuit wearing a Hillary Clinton mask standing on that float, styled as a jail, as water balloons, hundreds of them, handed out to the crowd with which to pelt the Hillary Clinton impersonator. Here to discuss the float and the political mood in West Central Iowa, Doug Burns joins us, co-owner of the Herald Publishing Company, publishes 9 papers across Western and Central Iowa. He's a longtime political columnist and reporter. Doug Burns, great to have you on the program again.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
Did I describe that parade scene correctly, you think?
Absolutely. It sounds just like the Associated Press story that went all over the world.
Okay. So tell us, what was the reaction, according to the press reports, of that unusual float, highly politicized float?
Right. Well, the story originated with our reporter, Matt Razab, who went out expecting to, you know, just spend a couple of hours covering a small town celebration. For example, this coming weekend we have Carol Fest and Audubon has T-Bone Days. There's Lake Panorama Days. You know, these are the types of things that go on in Iowa every weekend. And, you know, we figured we'd get a few photos, celebrate the in Arcadia, this was the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Volunteer Fire Department. So that's what we were expecting. And then Matt comes back to the newsroom with these photos of, as you described perfectly, somebody, a Hillary Clinton imposter, somebody costumed as Hillary Clinton in a orange jumpsuit, and then they had a sort of a makeshift jail, prison, with barbed wire and fencing rigged around it, a sign that said Hillary for prison, and then they handed out water balloons to people, adults, kids, and so forth. So anyway, we reported it and in Tuesday's paper and ended up with more hits and comments. It's the second most hits and comments we've ever had since we launched our website in 2003.
I guess the irony here, too, is that an FBI probe recently concerning the email issue found no basis for criminal charges against Hillary Clinton. But this week, Doug, I'm sure you're aware of this, a federal judge denied Donald Trump's effort to have a fraud case involving Trump University thrown out because there was, in the words of the federal judge, a genuine issue about whether Trump knowingly participated in a fraud scheme. Last time I checked, Doug, you can be put in jail for fraud, right?
Yeah, exactly. And James Comey, the FBI director who did serve in President George W. Bush's Justice Department in early July, he said that he and his professionals didn't find any clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws with the emails. It was a careless use, was their description. And I know a lot of women Hillary Clinton's age who, you know, do have some trouble with technology. And,
Okay, Doug, we have to take a break. We're going to come back with you. Stay on the line.
Sure.
I want to talk with you about the popularity of Donald Trump as a candidate in the 3rd and 4th districts there in western and central Iowa, the so-called down-ticket effect of the Trump candidacy. We'll be back with Doug Burns, co-owner of the Herald Publishing Company, to talk politics for a few minutes. Among other things, it's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition on Friday. Short conversations to touch on some news we didn't get to otherwise this week. Doug Burns is with me of the Herald Publishing Company, publishing 9 papers across western and central Iowa. Longtime political columnist and reporter. We wanted to touch bases with Doug Burns to talk about his read of current politics less than 100 days before our election, especially in Iowa's 3rd and 4th districts in the central and western part of the state. Doug, most people are saying Donald Trump had, I guess aside from his spokesperson, are saying he had a pretty bad week, certainly when you look at the polls. What's your takeaway on the winds that are blowing on the presidential election in your part of the state?
Well, I would agree. He had, I don't know how you could, it's almost like he had like a reverse deal with the devil or something. That's how bad the week was for him, the last 2 weeks, actually. I think there are a lot of people in the 4th district, though. Like if you look at Sioux County in 2014, Congressman King had 84.8% of the vote there. So there are some really strong pockets that they'll stick with Trump. And they'll stick with Congressman King, really, regardless of what they say. I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago suggesting that Congressman King could probably still win re-election, even if he routinely used the N-word every day, sprinkled in his conversations. And I haven't had anybody make a good argument that that couldn't happen.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about that 4th District. Steve King facing Democratic challenger Kim Weaver. You think unless something unforeseen and dramatic comes up, he's definitely the favorite there.
I mean, he could probably win from the grave. I don't see any, I covered every debate that Congressman King had with former First Lady Christy Vilsack. She ran an exceptional campaign and really couldn't come close. So the Democrat running Kim Weaver, while well-intended and certainly respected in grassroots circles, just doesn't have the kind of fundraising muscle or the sort of background that I think would appeal to swing voters. So I would expect King to have a very easy route, regardless of whether he out-trumps Trump.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Steve King has a penchant for controversial remarks that gained the attention of national media. His latest, just last month, really questioning what minorities have contributed to civilization.
Yeah, what was outrageous about that, a really good friend of mine, Dan Manat, who has farmland in the Ottoman area, pointed out in a brilliant column in our paper that hybrid corn, which is, you know, the number one commodity, it's the foundation of our economy here, Ben, in western Iowa, that was developed through the years with Central Americans, with Native Americans. And I have a wonderful picture of George Washington Carver, an African American, with Henry A. Wallace, the father of hybrid corn. So Congressman King doesn't even know the background of the number one commodity in his district.
Mm-hmm. King supporting Donald Trump. I mean, a lot of Republicans in Congress are hedging their bets, but Steve King not.
I got to give King credit, though. In a conversation I had with him about a year and a half ago, when there were 17 candidates, I said, "Who's the candidate I should watch, Congressman?" And he said, "Watch Trump." He didn't predict that Trump would emerge, you know, in the end directly, but I think he knows Trump fairly well. Trump was at his Faith and Freedom Summit event, and I think they get along behind the scenes fairly well. But as we both know, Congressman King was certainly tied very closely to Ted Cruz, and the way Trump treated the Cruz family, from Cruz's wife Heidi to his father, especially with those ties to those outrageous claims trying to connect Cruz's family to the Kennedy assassination. I can see why Congressman King's where he is.
Let's spend a couple minutes talking about the 3rd District, also in an area that you concern yourself with in newspapers. Congressman David Young, Republican in his first term, facing Democratic challenger Jim Maurer. He ran against King and lost in a past election. What does the race between Jim Maurer and David Young look like at this point?
You know, I would be in the third district. Voters, Ben, have a terrific choice. I think they're both outstanding candidates. It's one of those rare races where I think the district would be served well from a constituent service standpoint by either one. But to break down the politics for you, it'll be tough for Maurer to break through in some rural areas. I think Young will be very well funded in the fact that King doesn't have a strong opponent, the fact that Grassley appears to be in fairly good shape, the fact that a lot of Republicans are reluctant to throw support behind Trump. David Young would be a very safe and smart place for Republican money to go, for PAC money to go. So, a lot of organizations in D.C. have that as a toss-up race. I would put Young as the favorite, and I think what he pulled off a couple of years ago in Des Moines at the convention was pure political genius in terms of his ability to pull the nomination out of that convention hall.
Mm-hmm. So no downside to David Young because of the Trump candidacy? Does it because I know what is it, in the 3rd district we have about as many registered Republicans as Democrats, don't we?
There's a major opportunity there for Jim Maurer, absolutely, and more because of our, you know, Team Red versus Team Blue culture today that's even seeped into Iowa. You know, there might be if there's a situation where there's less ticket splitting, which I think might be the case, then sure, there's a big opportunity for Maurer to try to tie, and he's doing it almost daily in press releases, to try to tie Young to Trump, and also to triangulate and tie him to the Republican Congress, and you know, some votes that might not be popular in some circles in the district.
Okay, Doug Burns, that's all we have time for now. Thanks, we'll check back in with you. Doug Burns, co-owner of the Herald Publishing Company, longtime political columnist and reporter. Thanks for the view from central and western Iowa, Doug.
Appreciate it, Ben. Thank you for the show.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's mark now the passing of an important writer, a writer who for many years was part of the Iowa literary landscape, and a writer who influenced and mentored generations of writers. Pulitzer Prize winner and Iowa Writers Workshop Professor Emeritus James Allen McPherson died on July 27th. He was 72. McPherson was the author of two story collections, Hue and Cry and Elbow Room. Elbow Room earned him a Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1978. He was the first African-American writer to be awarded that honor. McPherson became a faculty member at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, the University of Iowa, in 1981. He was a recipient of several prestigious fellowships, including awards from the MacArthur Foundation, also the Guggenheim Foundation. In 1995, he was inducted into the Academy of Arts and Sciences. And joining us to tell us a little bit more about his life and work, director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, Lan Samantha Cheng, welcome to our studio.
It's great to be here.
Give us a sense of James McPherson's fiction, why it earned him a Pulitzer. And perhaps, I don't know, you have a book there. Read a little passage from his work to give us a sense.
Sure. Jim was an extraordinary fiction writer, and one of the great gifts he had was to be able to write very sort of respectfully and beautifully, and also simply about people, his characters, for whom he showed a great deal of respect. Many of his, you know, in his characters, he grew up in the South during segregation, born in the 1940s, and he wrote about people who lived in those circumstances, and he wrote about their lives with such enormous sort of respect and gracious interest. And there's something about his prose, I think, that treats these characters in a way that doesn't call attention to the prose itself. I noticed this particularly recently when I was rereading his work. When he died, several of us happened to be in California at a writers' conference, and we'd all studied with him, including Yi-Yun Lee and the director of the conference and myself, and we sat down with his books for a while and we read them and thought about how sort of beautiful and yet unembellished the writer was, not at all calling attention to the writer, but focusing very deeply on the characters. I actually found it difficult to sort of excise sections of prose that called attention to itself. And I thought that it would be sort of maybe fitting in this moment to read a little bit about what Jim wrote about Iowa in his memoir, Crab Cakes, a really beautiful book. He's just trying to describe a little bit about what Iowa's like to people who might not have encountered it. You know, having grown up in Georgia himself, I think he has a special view of this place. Here, seasons regulate habits. Form here still follows function. Routine inspires the approach to style. In work towards specific ends, as in nature, the fundamental ends of life are covertly celebrated as nothing more than normal. Speech is therefore plain and muscular. Simplicity is expected, embellishment and pretension politely discouraged. Until recent years, Iowa was said to be, quote, the best kept secret in the country, unquote. The state has benefited thus far from the farsightedness or the nearsightedness of Easterners and Westerners. Inhabitants are only somewhat aware of the irony at the center of confusion over the whereabouts of the I states. though the use of irony is little understood or employed here, except among the few with intellectual pretensions, most inhabitants of the state would just as well others never learned the difference. Population, 3.5 million and holding steady. Unofficial colors, green, especially during the spring and summer, brown during the fall, and white, winter. Major products, corn, soybean, winter wheat, pork, cattle, civility, peace, and healing. Future, unknown. I recollect that time, too. I remember that I rested in Iowa for many years.
Oh, that's a beautiful passage from Crab Cakes, written by James Allen McPherson, who died on July 27th, read there by the director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, Lan Samantha Chang. Very quickly, before we have to go, Samantha, we don't have much time. How will he be remembered most at the workshop?
Oh, you know, he gave the workshop an extraordinary legacy of love. I often feel that he gave us so much of himself because he came to this town, you know, at a stage in his life where he was really interested in focusing on giving to others. Our community was the wonderful, lucky recipient of this attention and love. He was a wonderful mentor to students, including writers such as Z.Z. Packer, Yi-Yun Lee, and Marcus Burke more recently. He taught at our program for over 30 years. And as a student of his myself, I will always remember his incredible gentleness in the classroom and the example he set to all of us that a great writer does not need to call attention to himself, but to his subject.
Okay. Thank you very much for helping us celebrate the life of James Allen McPherson, who died on July 27th. Lan Samantha Chang, director of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Thanks for joining us on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our week. That's what News Buzz is all about. Joining me now, Jacqueline Hallbloom, Iowa Public Radio classical music host and host of IPR's monthly Iowa Arts Showcase that airs tomorrow, Saturday, August 6th at 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. on Iowa Public Radio Classical. Jacqueline, great to have you on the program again.
Thank you so much for having me come.
Love this conversation because we always find out what's coming in the month ahead of us, the month we have just started in terms of arts. You highlight a number of them. What have we got on your program today and what's going on in Iowa?
Well, actually, starting today in Iowa is the Bix Beiderbecke Festival, and it's their 45th annual. And this is pretty cool because if you aren't familiar with Bix Beiderbecke, he's an Iowan. He was born in Davenport and really set the jazz world on its ear with his playing not only trumpet but also piano.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you talk with Josh Duffy about this? Who's Josh Duffy?
He's like the head honcho. He's a fantastic, world-renowned 1920s percussionist who happens to live in Davenport, and he has taken this festival under his wing, and they are just having a whole lineup of some terrific bands, including his band that's going to be performing in venues across Bettendorf as well as in Davenport. And some really fine musicians are going to be performing, and they have not only concerts but dancing and some great food there and lots of hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Up in Waterloo, you're marking the Community Playhouse of Waterloo's 100th anniversary.
Yes, can you believe it? Like, during World War I, the Waterloo Community Playhouse got started. I mean, people wanted theater, and they've had 100 years of successful theater, and I guess it was a little slim maybe during World War I and World War II, but they are really going strong and have put together a terrific 100th anniversary season, including things like To Kill a Mockingbird, A Christmas Story, The Rocky Horror Show, Rumors, and Spam-A-Lot. And they're also going to have a spam jam this year.
So. All right. Heading down from Waterloo to the south, from the very old to the very new, the New Hampshire is opening up soon. You had a conversation with Chuck Swanson, the executive director of Hampshire. And Jacqueline,
I pass by this new structure. I've watched it being built. It is amazing. It looks like a starship that's going to leave our planet for some other faraway galaxy. It's a great structure.
It sounds fantastic. I can hardly wait to see it. And, of course, when you hear Chuck talk about it, you want to see it. They just hung two amazing works of art there. They're going to be starting to have opening houses on September 9th and September 11th. And on the 16th, they're going to have a free concert, outdoor concert, with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band and Trombone Shorty. It's going to be a great opening and some terrific shows. Get your tickets. Don't wait.
Right.
Things are selling out.
Oh, and I hear the acoustics. Just yesterday talked with a musician, a flautist, who has been helping to test the acoustics on the new stage. He says it's amazing. So, yes, do check out the New Hampshire when you have the opportunity to do that. Let's move over to Des Moines, the Des Moines Symphony. What's going on there?
Well, the Des Moines Symphony is starting their 79th season called Ode to Joy, and it's going to be opening in September with none other than Beethoven's Ninth and a whole bunch of choirs and hundreds of musicians. Just a terrific, terrific season. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this month the Des Moines Symphony is going to play at the State Fair. They're going to open the State Fair on August 11th and the opening night, and they're going to do a free concert at the State Fair, and they're going to play Peter Hamlin's Symphony on a Stick. So it was written about the State Fair, and so they're going to be performing it at the State Fair. It's going to be one of those wild events.
And finally, Jacqueline, let's talk about something happening at the Figge Art Museum in the Quad Cities, a new exhibit that focuses on the Wizard of Oz.
It's a tremendous exhibit, and two gentlemen, Willard Carroll and Tom Wilhite, have this collection of over 100,000 Oz items.
100,000, did you say?
100,000. They're going to bring 100 of the best to the Figge.
Like what?
Oh, like Dorothy's dress from her screenplay, like one of the outfits from the Munchkins, like the ruby slippers. I mean, the list goes on and on. Lots of pretty cool stuff in this collection. And apparently Willard Carroll started collecting was like 5 years old. So there's some pretty cool things in this exhibit. And they're bringing in John Fricke, who is an authority on the Wizard of Oz and also an authority on Judy Garland. And he knows everything there is to know. And he also has connections to the Quad Cities because for 8 years he hosted and emceed the Miss Iowa pageant in the Quad Cities. So he's coming back. He's going to talk about this wonderful film that they're going to be showing on the 13th, which is a 35-millimeter version of the Technicolor-like process of The Wizard of Oz. They're going to show this at the Adler at 2 and 7 p.m. It just costs $3 a family to get in. It's wonderful to see this. And then he's also talking on the 11th, I believe, and giving a special lecture about how they made The Wizard of Oz and all sorts of things. So they're really doing it upright.
Definitely something I'll have to check out. I am a huge Wizard of Oz fan. But you know, Jacqueline, here's a confession that for the first time on the airwaves, at least, about The Wizard of Oz. I was once banned from watching The Wizard of Oz. Do you know why?
I have no idea.
I must have been 7 or 8. My mother, it was at the time when it was played every fall, right? Once a year, you had one shot at it on network television, right? Remember this, right?
Absolutely.
And my mother got tired year after year. I would watch it. I would be thrilled by it. And then she would have to put up with little Benjamin waking up with nightmares and waking her up and the whole family up. It affected me that much. That lasted until I was about 30 years old, then I was able to watch it again without nightmares.
Well, if you go to this exhibit, they do have one of the flying monkeys there, so I'm going to warn you that.
They were in my nightmares, for sure. And those shoes that curled up under the house.
They're there, too.
We have a little music from the original Wizard of Oz to go out. Jacqueline Hallbloom, Iowa Public Radio classical music host of IPR's monthly Iowa Arts Showcase. Do check it out on tomorrow, August 6th, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. on Iowa Public Radio Classical. So fun to spend time with you, Jacqueline.
Thanks a bunch, Ben.
Let's go out with the Munchkin Welcome.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Graham Bly. All our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River, a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. At the end of this work week, remember, there's no place like home. Talk to you again on Monday.